There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This podcast contains explicit language.
The government might shut down next week, partly because Donald Trump refuses to help Dreamers without getting his wall or other policy changes at least fully, reports from the Capitol. The Trump administration wants work requirements for Medicaid, so we talked to health policy reporter Jonathan Cohn about dog whistles. The federal government stood aside as states legalized marijuana under the Obama administration, but Attorney General Jeff Sessions is changing that. Nick Wing explains how the Justice Department is reasserting its authority on weed. And Jessica Schulberg reports that some clever lawyers are using Donald Trump's foolish statements to try to spring people out of Gitmo. I'm Arthur Delaney, and this is So That Happened, the HuffPost politics podcast about things that happened in the politics. Hello, this is Arthur Delaney, and my co-host Elise Foley is on Capitol Hill, where there is some breaking news. The government might shut down in like 9 days. Elise, what's going on?
Yeah, so about a month ago, Congress passed a very short-term government funding bill and kind of kicked this whole issue of funding the government to this month. And the reason they did that in part was that Democrats were asking for a whole bunch of things, including they wanted to pass some sort of protections to help Dreamers, young undocumented people who came to the U.S. as kids. And right now, we still have a week to go, but it is looking like things are going to shake out potentially the exact same way that they did last month, where there's still no deal on Dreamers. There is, you know, still no deal on all sorts of different other things, and there could either be a shutdown or there could be another short-term extension.
Now, before they went on their Christmas break last month, it seemed to me that Democrats did not really put up a fight about anything. They could have insisted on protections for Dreamers. They could have fought over how the tax bill might affect Medicare, and they just didn't do it. And Dreamers and immigration reform advocates were so mad. And called them the deportation caucus. And has the heat really turned up on Democrats from that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to say the heat has turned up because the heat was already on them pretty hard. There have been tons and tons of Dreamers coming to Capitol Hill for months now saying that, you know, please put protections for us into these bills. The thing is, Republicans say it should be done separately. But all of the previous immigration reform efforts that would give people legal status over the past dozen years have failed, and they have failed through various Republican refusals to hold votes in some cases. So there are a lot of reasons that Democrats and immigration reform activists think that this, putting it in some sort of must-pass bill, is really the only way to actually get something done. We'll see if that's correct, but a lot of the same things that killed past immigration reform bills are still problems now, and that's why they want this to be part of a must-pass bill.
In a sense, it's sort of arbitrary that we're saying Democrats have leverage in that, you know, whether Democrats make a stand could determine whether the government shuts down, because Democrats do not control either the House or Senate, do not control the White House, and if Republicans could stick together, they could do whatever they wanted. If they could all agree on their policy goal, they could fund the government exactly as they wish. But they don't. They've got guys who want what? Like a bunch more money for the military? Are there any other Republican primaries that are jumping out to you as of Thursday afternoon?
Yeah, I mean, the Republican outside immigration stuff is not as much my deal, but they do just have such disparate views, a lot of them, on government spending at all, that it makes it really hard for them to stick together. They have a lot of people who just don't want to vote for any type of government spending bill, and so that's why they need Democrats. In the Senate, they can't actually pass any bill unless it's in kind of strange circumstances, like they've done a little bit in the past, without 60 votes, so they do need some Democrats, but ultimately they can get things through with mostly just themselves if they can stick together. But in the House especially, that's been a problem.
You're right. The way I phrased that question was sort of inaccurate, because they do need 9 Democrats at least in the Senate. So Republicans want things on immigration, like a wall. Like Donald Trump wants funding for a wall, which we have to all pretend he didn't say Mexico would pay for it and act like paying money for a ridiculous 2,000-mile-long wall is like something we legitimately have to negotiate. And it presumably it's not just the wall. It's also like enhanced security, other provisions.
They've said for a while that it's not, you know, that they don't want a 2,000-mile wall. So, you know, that wasn't like a big revelation this week that Trump said that. He's said that for a while. Officials have said that for a while. But, yeah, they did this week kind of have a little bit of progress in that they came to a deal, the White House and lawmakers, about what they wanted as part of this deal. So they agreed at a meeting on Tuesday that they would do some sort of protections for Dreamers, not, you know, any detail about what that would look like, but some type of protections while also doing some type of border security, including a wall, but also technology and things like that, and ending the diversity visa lottery program, which Trump has repeatedly completely mischaracterized and lied about how it works. But that's a topic for another time. And ending chain migration, which is the term that he likes to use, that restrictionists like to use, for family-based visas. So they've come to broad agreement on that. The problem is that a lot of those things are really, really contentious, not just with Democrats, but with Republicans as well. So just saying, okay, we'll do these 4 things, well, what is that going to look like? What would a DACA fix look like? What does ending chain migration look like? So there's still a lot to be worked out.
Ending chain migration looks like splitting up families, basically.
So they say they would still let people sponsor their spouses and or their minor kids. But, you know, I think most of us would consider probably like I consider my brothers to be my pretty close family members. So it would be giving up things like that.
The White House did an unusual thing. We saw this happen, I believe, once with President Obama, where they televised the meeting between the president and members of Congress from both parties. And this came on the heels of a couple of weeks where everyone was calling Trump probably the dumbest person in the world. And he didn't like throw up or fall over. And people said, wow, Trump is really making a lot of sense. But the things he actually said about policy did not make sense, did they, Elise?
Yeah, I mean, he sort of just seemed to be agreeing with whatever the person who spoke right before him said. So there was a moment where Senator Dianne Feinstein, I believe, said something about they wanted a clean Dream Act. What that means in, you know, Capitol Hill lingo is something that was is only that, passing, you know, that and not tie it to other things. And he said, yeah, clean Dream Act, that sounds good. And then Republicans had to correct him and be like, no, that's not what we want. And the White House had to be like, well, when he said clean, he meant with these other 3 things. So I don't know if I would say that it was like an amazing performance by him. He claimed that people wrote him letters to say that it was a great performance.
That was so weird.
It was so weird. I often go down the train of the, like, imagine if Obama did this, but that one did make me think of it, how strange that would be and how many people would be like this arrogant jerk. So anyway.
Oh, well, he said people sent us letters, and reporters were like, well, who sent you a letter, and how did the mail get to you from wherever it had been sent in less than 9 hours? And it was a list of tweets, and one of them was by Sam Stein.
Really? So, our former colleague, Sam Stein.
Right. So that was lame. Anyway, so Elise, just to reiterate, it looks like they're pretty far apart. And that it looks like Democrats are making a firmer stand this time than they did in December.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, I think that the problem is that there might be another situation like there was last time that they can pass something with mostly Republicans if it is just a little short-term thing like they did before. So, you know, you can have a lot of Democrats take a stand and say, I won't vote for anything that doesn't protect Dreamers, that doesn't do these other things like children's health insurance, all of these other proposals. But you need enough of them to stay together and do that. And it's not clear that that anything has changed on that front.
All right, Elise Foley, great reporting. Thanks for your hard work on Capitol Hill. And we'll be right back. We're back. This is Arthur Delaney, and I'm joined in studio by special guest, my colleague, Jonathan Cohn.
Good to be here.
Jonathan, you're normally working from Michigan, so it's a pleasure to have you in Washington, where I'm sure you're here for something intellectual conference.
I came here to be part of the podcast. That's a very intellectual exercise.
You're here to talk to us about something that I think is very important because it's going to be a preview for actually a lot of policy fights that I think will become a major theme of this year. And it is so-called work requirements for programs run by the government to help poor people from starving to death, basically. And the Trump administration has said it will soon allow states to impose work requirements on Medicaid recipients. And Medicaid benefits, it covers 70 million people, poor people, by helping them pay for medical care. So it's a really important program. And Republicans have wanted this for a long time. They didn't get to take a big whack at Medicaid and their Obamacare repeal bill like they wanted to last year. So, Jonathan, what's going to happen? Explain exactly what the Trump administration's going to let states do and then what the states will actually do.
Right. So Medicaid's an entitlement program. The law says you are entitled to it if you fall into the following categories.
Well, let's actually – entitlement program. Because Republicans say the word entitlement to make it sound like it's like bratty, spoiled kids.
Right.
Like, oh, you're entitled.
Ooh. Yes, yes, yes. And remember, you know, that Social Security is an entitlement program. And
yeah.
Medicare is an entitlement program. And, you know, the idea behind these programs, you like them, you don't like them, whatever. But, you know, the idea is that at some point we as a country got together and said, these people are American citizens. They are contributing to society, and we owe them as a society the following things. And one of them is healthcare. And Medicaid, you know, was created to serve people who are poor, and that includes a lot of seniors. It includes a lot of disabled people. Includes a whole ton of children. The law says if you fall into one of these categories, then you know, you are entitled to this coverage.
Furthermore, even though states administer the program locally, because it is an entitlement, states cannot do screwy things to keep black people from receiving benefits from the program.
Well, that's right. That's right. And Medicaid is a very – of the big entitlement programs, we talk about the big three, right? Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Medicaid is by far the most complicated because it is run by the states. Mostly or a majority of money comes from the federal government, but the states kick in their own money. They have a lot of flexibility over who to cover. But then once they decide who to cover, there are rules for how they cover them. And that's where this is all coming from, which is all – the program is written in such a way to give states some flexibility.
Right.
But within certain guidelines. And this is basically a bunch of states saying we want more flexibility. And in particular, we have a bunch of states that are lined up and saying, we want to say that if we won't give Medicaid to people who could be working but aren't.
Yeah.
They tried this. They've tried this before. The Obama administration made very clear that, no, they would not approve those requests, both because they thought it was bad policy. And you know, we can talk about why a good or bad policy. And they thought it was illegal. They said their reading of the Medicaid laws, they can't even allow that.
I should explain why I mentioned African Americans, because historically, I mean, going back to before the Civil War, states' rights meant enslaving people. And then in the 20th century, local control of federal programs meant excluding African Americans from the benefits of those programs. Sure. And it was never – it's a way of a racist policy that is – in which nobody is being explicitly racist at the federal level. But that's the outcome. And that's not what's exactly happening here. However, I do think that with throwing words around like welfare, which we'll be hearing a lot of, that it's something that hasn't really been reckoned with, and it's part of the policy situation that we've got.
Well, yeah, I mean, anytime we get into the politics of welfare, there's a racial element, and I was going to say there was a racial subtext to it, but it's often the text.
What I am not saying is that it's mostly African Americans or minorities who benefit from these programs. It's mostly white people. Or it's a plurality of white people in a given state because most people in the country are white. But that's the political connotation, I think.
That is the political connotation. And I would go further to say I think there's a perfect – you know, there are intellectually defensible positions for why you'd want a work requirement that have nothing to do with race. You know, it's because you support work requirements doesn't mean you're a racist. But I think there's no question that politically Republicans are going after this in part. You know, there is a racial subtext to the politics, and again, it's not that subtle. And I think you mentioned about how the fight was shifting this year. I think one way to think about this is Republicans spent the last year, running into walls over healthcare repeal, and I think the lesson came through that is not a politically advantageous position for them. This is not working for them. They are losing popularity. So now they're falling back on their more familiar tack, which is to attack welfare. And Medicaid falls into that. We're going to see it, as you know, if you've written on food stamps, all kinds of other programs. And I imagine their calculation, to the extent this is about politics, is that they have a better chance of winning a fight on welfare than they do on healthcare.
I think their chances in Congress are pretty slim because it's an election year. But what the Trump administration is doing, Congress is not part of the equation. So there's actually a strong chance of at least some success initially. First, tell us, how does a work requirement work for Medicaid? Medicaid is something that you go to the doctor and you have – having previously applied for Medicaid, the program pays for your doctor visit and treatment.
Right. So, I mean, this is a good question. How it would actually work in practice is actually a very good question. I mean, presumably what this means, you have to sign up for Medicaid. You're not automatically enrolled into Medicaid, so you have to go into Medicaid. So presumably if a state wants to do this, let's say Kentucky, which is sort of first in line of states that really want to jump on this, when they determine your eligibility for the program, somehow they're going to have to determine, are you able-bodied? Are you working? Are you looking for work? And that actually raises a very interesting policy question, which is, we've learned from experience with other programs, that's actually a fairly large administrative burden. It's complicated for the state to check all things. They're going to have to spend a lot of money going through the background checks and whatever. Now, the flip side is it also makes applying for Medicaid more complicated, and inevitably there are going to be people who will not even apply to Medicaid or will give up with the documentation, even though they're still eligible for it. And so you get to a situation where if you impose these work requirements, inevitably what will happen is there will be fewer people on Medicaid. In some cases, it will be because these are people who could be working and are not, and they're being denied coverage. For some people, it will be people who can't work, who remain eligible for the program, but it's become so difficult to sign up that they just don't.
Because you will have to potentially provide evidence that you have applied for jobs at these places, including by you're going to give the state phone numbers of the companies that you applied for. You'll probably have to, if you're given benefits, go apply again, recertify, which could involve travel. That's not necessarily easy if you're poor and don't have a car or gas. So I guess I'm just amplifying what you said. The work requirement itself is something that's kicks people off the program. I think work requirement really deserves scare quotes because it's basically if you don't have a job, we kick you off after a period of time.
Right. Now, if you look at the order that the administration made, and certainly they say, look, we don't want to hurt kids. Obviously, kids can't work, right? We don't want to hurt people.
Not yet.
That's right. We don't want to punish people who have true, you know, have have disabilities, are not able to work. We want to take that into account. Interestingly, the statement from the Trump administration today made a special mention of, you know, if people are getting treatment for opioid addiction, we don't want to be punishing those people either. But, you know, the devil's in the details, right? So, you know, as they, you know, that's nice to say that they're going to let do that, but how are they in practice going to do that? And I think, you know, if you've been around long enough, if you've covered – again, and you've covered this more than I have and, you know, in the context of food stamps and other programs, I think we all know that when you impose these work requirements, a lot of this is just about, you know, this is a way to thin the rolls. And you're putting up roadblocks, and a lot of people are just going to lose coverage. And, you know, you can argue, well, that's a worthwhile trade-off or not, but it's important to be clear-eyed about what the pluses and minuses are, who's going to suffer, and actually what's going to cost in the long run.
It's good to talk about the goal more explicitly. It is about reducing the number of people on it. That was the outcome they achieved when they put work requirements on a program called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Almost nobody gets it now. Compared to the number of people who are eligible and the number of people who received it in the past. And they said, well, that's a victory. And they're pretty explicit about how kicking people off was a policy win.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, look, and I should say, I mean, anyone who's – if you've ever interviewed people about this, I mean, there's a real – number one, there's a real resentment from some people that, you know, when they see, hey, my tax dollars are going to pay for someone who's not employed. That resentment is real. It's out there. And, you know, some of that could be pure unadulterated racism. Some of it has nothing to do with race. Some of it is, hey, I'm working hard. I'm making $40,000 a year. I'm struggling to pay my health insurance premiums. Why does somebody over there getting it for free? I've heard that. I can understand that. I think what's interesting is, you know, you look at that situation, right? So you have somebody making $40,000 a year struggling to pay for their health care, who feels, you know, resentment towards someone getting it for free. You know, you can answer that by taking away the free health insurance from the person who's too poor to get it. Or you could go to that, try to figure out, well, what can we do for that person making $40,000 a year so that maybe they pay a little bit for their health care but not quite so much.
Work requirement is also sort of a weasel word like entitlements in that it automatically sounds so sensible, like, oh, people who can work should. And then it will, you know, the fact that you have to then determine which slice of people who may be caretakers, parents, or disabled are actually supposed to be subject to this. But it is against the backdrop of a much better economy. It's something that, you know, they could impose without creating too much hardship in the short run, which is, I think, what happened actually with welfare reform of the 1990s. And then the economy tanks, and it's a complete disaster. But they'll get sued.
Yes.
So I mean, they won't. They can't they can start doing it, but they can't necessarily keep doing it.
Right. So, I mean, the again, you know, one of the reasons the Obama administration would reject these applications is they'd say, look, we read the Medicaid law that created Medicaid. It says we can't do this. The Trump administration is saying, yes, we can. That's a funny juxtaposition. I just thought about that. And we'll see. The courts will have something to say about it. I am not an expert in Medicaid law. I mean, you know, if you read the sort of proposal, it was written in such a way very clearly to make – you know, it's interesting. It was framed very much as we think this will improve health outcomes. And, you know, they were citing the data that, you know, well, if people work, they get better health outcomes. And that's their justification for it. And that, to me, I'm guessing, was very clearly an opening bid on the argument they'll make in court, which is that, well, we deserve this. We should approve these because actually it serves the long-term goals of Medicaid, which is making people healthier. I don't think the data actually supports work requirements leading to that outcome, but that's, you know, that's what they would argue.
All right, Jonathan Cohn, thanks so much for filling us in on the coming fight over Medicaid work requirements, a preview for the broader work requirements fight that we'll see all year.
Yes, we will.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, everybody. This is Arthur Delaney, and I'd just like to take a moment to request that you give us a rating of 4 or 5 stars on iTunes, but please not fewer than 4 stars, or I will shut down the government myself. Thank you. Hello, we're back. This is Arthur Delaney. I'm joined in studio by my colleague Nick Wing, who is an expert on weed.
Total expert. Thanks for having me, Arthur.
So the voters in California recently legalized it, which brings the total number of states with legal recreational use to several. And then the U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinded a guidance that his predecessor had issued under the Obama administration that had basically told federal prosecutors to lay off on weed because it just shouldn't be a top priority. States are legalizing it. It's clearly not very dangerous. So rescinding that guidance, what does that mean? It's a big deal. It's certainly a big reversal in the federal government's the direction it was going on this basically harmless plant.
Right. I mean, as you say, under the last couple years of the Obama administration, they had pretty much decided not to prosecute marijuana operations that were state compliant, that were complying with the state laws on marijuana. So it really sent a message, I think, that it was a good time for investors to get involved. I mean, if you wanted to start cultivating and you applied for the licensing, you could do that. The idea that, you know, the DEA would come kicking down your door as of a dispensary that was in compliance and paying their taxes and following the regulations, that had sort of begun to fade. So you had, I think, as a result to the lowered risk, you had people sort of getting involved in the business, and it was becoming more normalized and mainstream. And, you know, this really sets a tonal shift in the opposite direction, which is that U.S. attorneys, the sort of top prosecutor in each of these districts, now has the – I mean, I guess they technically had the authority, but they now have really the blessing of the attorney general to go after state legal operations that are conflicting with the federal law, which obviously still believes that marijuana is a Schedule I drug like heroin and all that.
That's a good point. The actual legal status under federal law for marijuana has never changed. They still insanely consider it as dangerous as heroin, yep, which causes many people to die, even though marijuana causes no people to die or really even be hurt at all. So have prosecutors indicated that they're going to make use of the new regime and go after pot businesses, or has the status quo prevailed for now?
For now, the status quo is prevailing. No U.S. attorney came out with a really aggressive statement sort of suggesting that they were going to take Jeff Sessions up on his invitation to reignite these federal crackdowns. But, you know, I don't think people have a lot of good faith in prosecutors to not ever use a prosecutorial tool that they're given, right? So I think it's fair for people to be wary, certainly more concerned than they were before. But I also think, you know, it's worth pointing out that U.S. attorneys are – they're sort of political positions. They are beholden to people in their state. They're beholden to not just the sort of residents of the state, but also the state-based law enforcement apparatus. So various prosecutors at the state level, various law enforcement agencies at the state level. So if they were to choose to really mount a crackdown in a real way, you know, kick down doors, start trying to throw people in jail, they'd be running against groups of people, I think, that are not really into that. I mean, I think
– In other words, the country has changed a lot on weed. More people favor it being legal for recreational use, and it could be a reputational risk for a federal prosecutor to try to make a name for his or herself by busting up a state legal weed business.
Right. And, you know, as Ryan and I pointed out, Ryan Riley and I pointed out in the story, these people have political aspirations often. They want to run for statewide office. They want to run for Congress or for the U.S. Senate or whatever it is. And if you have a reputation of locking up people who are complying with the state law and doing something that's highly unpopular at the state level, that's going to make that more difficult for you. So, you know, as you say, I think there's this question, which is, you know, can you put the genie back in the bottle? Are we over this as a society? Is the norm now in a lot of these states that this is not something we want to focus on? And I think the experts and people involved in this say yeah. And it's not just people. It's not just customers or pot smokers themselves. It's actually the law enforcement officers are saying, look, we have a raging opioid crisis. We have all these other things to deal with. We have limited resources. We don't want to be spending our time, and the federal government shouldn't be spending its time cracking down on marijuana.
One thing that I thought was strange and continues to think is strange is that Democrats in Congress were like, how dare Jeff Sessions do this? Because, you know, children with illnesses and troops returning from war need medicinal marijuana, which I thought was just a, you know, true and all, but a political hedge. Like, why are you trying to find these extremely sympathetic groups when marijuana itself is clearly harmless to beneficial? Why are you so afraid to just say it ought to be illegal? Because the fact that they're afraid to say that means it's going to continue to be illegal for a really long time. It seems like we're as far away as ever from some sanity in federal law.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear still that rightly or wrongly, and I would say wrongly, people are wrong to think that there's a stigma, but there is obviously still, you know, legalizing marijuana, the idea of really being a marijuana reform champion at the federal level as a politician, there's a taboo there. And I think the polling would suggest that that is the wrong read, that you can be a popular politician. In fact, it might make you more popular to be an outspoken champion for reforming these laws.
Is it that popular off the top of your head, or is that how far polls have swung in favor of legal marijuana?
I mean, in the last couple of years, it's come from, you know, a majority support being a big deal till every poll is majority support for legalizing at the federal level, and people support the state laws once they get passed. So it's certainly a majority opinion. There have been polls, you know, there is still sort of a partisan divide. I think it's more popular among Democrats than it is among Republicans. But increasingly, we're seeing that even Republicans are starting to support this. So, I mean, certainly from the Democratic perspective, this is something I've been thinking a lot about. Why isn't the Democratic Party really latching on and just trying to establish themselves as the party of legal weed?
The loudest senator criticizing Jeff Sessions was Cory Gardner, who is a Republican. Are Democrats going to let Cory Gardner and Republicans take the issue away? I lump this in with their hesitancy on a whole range of liberal causes that you'd think they would just go for, such as single-payer health care. But no, it seems like they're stuck in this pattern of needing to appeal to a center that has – long since basically disappeared when you've got like Jeff Sessions and the Trump administration doing this weird Archie Bunker stuff and being openly racist. It just seems like a very strange moment that Democrats are a little behind. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah. I mean, it now seems like the perfect time to really establish themselves as not the party of old white squares, right? I mean, yet there is hesitancy to step away from that. And I don't really get it. And I think it would be a huge benefit to the Democratic Party to really take up that mantle. But, you know, they haven't made a lot of really politically adept decisions in the last couple of years.
And how many people have OD'd on marijuana in world history?
We've been tracking this closely, and the answer is still zero.
Oh, really? Because once in a while you do see a story like, man, had marijuana, died.
Well,
and it's like a TV station somewhere.
Right. I mean, you know, obviously taking drugs and dying while you're on them is not the same as overdosing on them. People
right,
do
right.
all kinds of stupid things. Taking substances, you know, and as we've talked about with other drugs on this program before, you know, it's not always a direct causal thing. You know, just if you fall off a cliff when you're high on marijuana, is that because you were high? It's possible. People do dumb things. Or did you get too close to the edge and slip?
So what is the marijuana industry doing? Have they just continued selling marijuana and been like, okay?
It sounds like for now the companies that are already sort of established are just proceeding as normal. And, you know, obviously they're keeping a closer eye on this. I think where it does have an immediate effect and what I think actually may have been Jeff Sessions' real goal here is that in an industry that's based on risk and speculation, this adds risk and makes people less willing to sort of speculate. So new entrants are probably seeing a harder time getting loans. You know, some of the bigger risk-averse financial institutions.
It's bad for capital formation.
Right. Absolutely. And so I think Jeff Sessions really just wants to make the legal marijuana industry sweat a little bit. And I'm sure he's doing that. And, you know, whether or not this pans out into any sort of real enforcement action, he's at least done that. And I'm sure that makes him very happy.
A funny thing is the District of Columbia has legal recreational weed use. It smells like weed everywhere that I go, which is fine. And there are companies that will deliver weed to your house. Now, it's not legal to buy or sell weed, but the scheme that our legal weed industry is using is that you will order from them a cigarette lighter or a piece of rolling paper.
Cookies.
Yeah, or like a hemp wick. And they will drive it to your house and say, hello, sir, here is the product you ordered. And here also is a free gift of a pile of marijuana. And I got to imagine if the Justice Department did want to make a big fuss, they could just do it here. But they don't seem that eager to, which is, I guess, is good.
Yeah, I find those things a little bit fascinating. I don't know how they work, and I guess they're open to that. I guess we'll see what happens. I think the city would not want Jeff Sessions meddling in their business like that, and it would probably be something that he would see some pushback on. But
right, well, there'd be an amazing backlash because DC is very liberal, very democratic, very against the war on drugs. But, you know, they're right here, and the federal government has weird jurisdictional control over the city, and specifically federal police control little pockets of it all over. So it's an interesting conflict.
And regardless of your views, I mean, whether you think these companies are right or wrong, they're not paying the sort of taxes that they would be, and they're not facing the sort of regulation that they would be if we had a system of taxation and regulation. So ultimately, the city itself is seeing less of a benefit than it would be if Congress would just stop trampling on the rights of the city.
I just want to say again, it blows my mind that marijuana and heroin remain in the same category under federal law. It's like the dumbest thing imaginable. I mean, people like you who are very familiar and know the details of federal drug policies are bored of that. But someone like me who, you know, I'm less in the weeds there, it's just incredible. It's so stupid.
It sounds so stupid, but people like Jeff Sessions very recently sort of still drew that parallel, saying that marijuana is only slightly less horrible than heroin. So it's clear that even as absurd as that sounds on its face, there are people who are still stuck in that mindset where they can kind of bring themselves to see a parallel.
Yeah, didn't he once joke that when he was a prosecutor, he went after like a Nazi or someone because they were selling weed?
Well, he thought they were – I guess what his joke was that he thought they were decent people until he found out that they smoked marijuana.
Hilarious joke. All right.
You got to be Jeff Sessions to make that joke.
Nick Wing, thanks so much for filling us in on this. We'll be right back. We're back. This is Arthur Delaney. I'm joined in studio by my colleague Jessica Schulberg.
Hello.
Jessica, you have news from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. What's going on?
Correct. It's actually news from D.C. that relates to Guantanamo Bay.
Oh, that's much more precise.
I know. A group of lawyers from a couple of human rights groups called Reprieve and the Center for Constitutional Rights joined together to file a legal filing on behalf of 11 prisoners who are still at Guantanamo Bay. These guys have been there between 10 and 16 years. Some of them have brought forth habeas filings in the past, arguing that their detention was indefinite and unlawful. It didn't really work.
Habeas corpus being the ancient legal principle that you can't just throw people in prison forever with no charges.
You would forget that it exists, given how often we seem to do that.
Yeah, oops.
But anyways, these guys have kind of a clever legal argument, I think, much in the way that the lawyers who took on Trump and fought his travel ban targeting Muslim-majority countries, these guys are using Trump's own statements against him to show that he is intending to act in a way that's in violation of the law. So in this legal filing, they refer to a January 2017 tweet. In which Trump says, you know, no more prisoners should be transferred out of Guantanamo Bay. These are all really bad guys. They quote him saying that he's going to fill up Guantanamo with a lot of bad dudes. They quote him saying that this American terror suspect should be sent to Guantanamo Bay. And the point of all this is to show that unlike President Obama and President Bush, who did detain people for a pretty long time in ways that would seem quite arbitrary and indefinite, those guys had processes in place to review each prisoner's status, and they would say, you know, we're going to keep detaining so-and-so pursuant to our law of war authority to keep people off the battlefield. They were releasing some people. They said they wanted to close Guantanamo. And meanwhile, you have Trump here. He's not even pretending to have some sort of fancy law of war authority. He's just saying, I think these guys are bad. I don't need to prove why. I'm just going to keep them in there forever, which is blatantly illegal.
And like you mentioned, Trump's words to have had this kind of effect on a legal dispute. Groups have used Trump's words to defeat Trump in court.
Right. So the a lot of the legal challenges to the travel ban, they would pull out these really Islamophobic, horrible quotes from Trump to show that, hey, it kind of looks like this guy doesn't like Muslims. And it just so happens that all of these countries targeted on his travel ban list are Muslim-majority countries. Could it be that this is a religiously motivated action?
In other words, Donald Trump's statements, which may seem dumb and bigoted, are in fact not brilliant political strategy.
Correct. If I was Trump's lawyer, as I think everyone has already said, I would tell this man to shut the hell up.
Well, we in the news have tried not to sound too analytical when Donald Trump is saying something. Well, that's dumb. Shouldn't say that.
Yep.
In at least one arena, there are actually consequences for dumb things that Trump says. Now, how many people are still at Guantanamo roughly?
There's 41 people. There was over close to 800 at the height of the prison's population.
So President Obama wanted to close it down and got some people out of there, but that was the reason it didn't close. They had trouble sending them to other countries, trying them
in the United States. We have 13 prisoners who have been charged in the military commission system, which is the war court at Guantanamo. It's a huge mess. The 9/11 case is there. It's now in its several years into the pretrial process. Things are not going well there. But Congress, several years back, banned any U.S. funds from being used to transfer Guantanamo detainees to the U.S., so we can't exactly move those guys to a federal court in New York. The other problem the Obama administration was having is that there is a handful of these guys who are kind of known as forever prisoners. We don't have enough evidence to charge them, or the evidence we have is tainted by torture. But we also think they're too dangerous just to throw back to wherever they came from, or their country doesn't want them, or they would be tortured. But there are a number of people who were cleared for release under the Obama administration who are still there. They just couldn't find a country to put these guys. So in this new legal challenge with the 11 prisoners, two of those guys have already been cleared for release through this insanely extensive interagency process that is so time-consuming. They were put through all the processes, told they were going to go home, and are now just sitting in Guantanamo indefinitely.
If this filing succeeds, what could happen?
So I think putting all 11 guys together in this legal filing is sort of almost a symbolic show of strength. They each will have to most likely proceed down their own habeas battle. But the lawyers in this filing are basically saying, like, there is no other remedy for our clients to go free except by court order. You know, there used to be this system that was kind of a huge mess, but at least some people were going free. And now the only way that any prisoner is going to get out of Guantanamo, even if there's no reason to hold them, there's no evidence against them, they are not a danger to our country, the only way that they will leave Guantanamo under President Trump is if the court orders it to happen.
If a court ordered it to happen, it seems hard to imagine Trump not taking whatever action he could to prevent it from happening. Mm-hmm.
It would actually be interesting if this did become a protracted legal battle, because in this filing, in addition to saying, you know, indefinite detention is illegal, and that seems to be what Trump is embracing, they also say that the authority, the legal authority to hold these guys is kind of ridiculous at this point. They're being held under the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which, as our listeners probably know, is passed after 9/11 to help us get terrorists off the battlefield, either by killing them or detaining them. Over the years, there's been several challenges to the AUMF politically. People say, you know, can we really use this to fight ISIS? Is this really still relevant? It's very, very old. But there's never actually been a big court case challenging it. So if this specific case does kind of make its way up, you might see lawyers having to actually battle whether or not the 2001 AUMF should still be a legal justification today.
If Congress rescinds the old authorizations for use of force, you know, they're quasi declarations of war, does that affect the rest of the cases at Guantanamo? Because it does seem like Congress could do something on the AUMF.
Yeah, it would affect everyone who's held at Guantanamo. I mean, Congress would have to write in some provision, which I assume they would, that would continue to cover the people at Guantanamo, because that is the legal authority we're using at this point to hold those guys.
Okay. Jessica Schulberg, thanks so much for catching us up on Gitmo.
Thank you.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Arthur Deloney, and this week we were joined by HuffPost reporters Elise Foley, Nick Wing, Jessica Schulberg, and Jonathan Cohn. So That Happened is available on Apple Podcasts. Check out the whole family of HuffPost podcasts in the iTunes store, and while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. And if you're still listening to this, please email sothathappened@huffpost.com. I just want to know what kind of person is listening and, like, really paying attention all the way until the very last second. Thank you so much for being that person.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.